Welcome to the Mormon News Report podcast for the week of August 14th, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With one full spoonful of snark, part of a well-balanced breakfast, Brian, because I know that you ate well-balanced breakfast when you were a kid.
I still try to. Hey, we've got a great show lined up for today. Playwright and screenplay writer Melissa Leilani Larson will be joining us to discuss her new book, Third Wheel, Peculiar Stories of Mormon Women in Love.
Which is so, so good. I highly recommend it to everybody. But first, just a reminder, the Mormon News Report extended sessions are now available to Patreon subscribers. For just $1 or more per month, you will receive access to the Mormon News Report podcast extended feed, which you can listen to through the Patreon app, or you can grab the feed from their website and dump it into wherever you get your podcast from.
And those extended interviews, Brant, are amazing.
They are so much fun to do. You know what? They give us a chance to, you know, loosen the ties, roll up the sleeves, and really get down to the good stuff. Plus, your $1 a month will help the Mormon News Report team to drive more resources to providing you with the best coverage, commentary, analysis, and a sprinkling of snark to breaking Mormon news. To those of you that do subscribe, and Brian, we do have a few, we thank you all for your support.
Yeah, it's growing, so we like to see that. You know, Brant, it seems like every week we say the same thing, but we really do have some important news to cover this week, so why don't we just get right into it?
Let's dive right in. Friend of the show, Terrell Givens, we've talked with him before. I think we can say we're on a first-name basis with him. What do you say?
Yeah, I think we're on a first-name basis. Of course, the next time I see him, he'll reintroduce himself to me and say, I'm Terrell, and you are?
And you are?
That's okay.
Yeah. So Terrell posted 10 facts about the Mormon religion this week over at the Oxford University Press website. So this might not seem like a very big deal, but thousands of academics follow Oxford University Press pretty closely, and this will be the starting point for a lot of scholars who are interested in discussing or researching the Mormon religion.
So by posting this short summary of beliefs, Terrell has a real opportunity to frame the discussion among academics who are starting to research Mormonism. So summarizing some of his key points, Given stated that God's ultimate goal is to create human happiness, that the fall of mankind was part of the plan, and that community is essential to salvation.
Additionally, Mormon roots are based on visions of God and visitations of angels, that the Book of Mormon is revealed scripture, and that Mormons maintain a literal belief in the house of Israel.
And finally, Givens stated that Mormonism is a sacramental religion that views ordinances as necessary for salvation, that Zion is the process of creating heaven on earth, and that while the church started in the eastern United States, Mormons eventually moved westward under the leadership of Brigham Young.
It's a really good and very academic rundown of the core tenets of Mormonism, and while I don't think it would happen, I'd be very intrigued to see if any on either the conservative or the progressive side of Mormon scholarship want to pick it apart, because there is something to be said about someone taking, you know, the tenets of Mormonism and saying, okay, this is what it means to, I don't think Terrell is saying this is what it means to me, but this is my interpretation of what those are, right?
And to be fair, that's how we got the Articles of Faith. It was, you know, George Wentworth asked Joseph Smith, tell me about what you guys believe. And that's how that thing came together. So Terrell's really, I'm not saying he's creating new Articles of Faith, but that's kind of the same type of thing, truncating Mormonism's beliefs.
Well, and to go along with that, how many people then are going to be reading that saying, okay, so this is Mormonism versus someone, and I think this is where the interesting discussion becomes, and this is where the interesting discussion happens, though I don't think it's going to happen. I'd love to see someone take, say, the Articles of Faith and Givens' list of Mormon beliefs and compare the two of them and say, okay, so if things changed or different. But I think there's something bigger here. We think that Terrell may have missed a few important facts on his list. And being the generous host that we are, I think we're going to throw Terrell a bone and help him out. What do you say, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, we've worked really hard on this. So let's go ahead and add a few points to Terrell's almost exhaustive list. So let's start with number one. Mormons believe in miracles. In fact, we pray over every meal, blessing the food that we're about to eat, praying that it may nourish and strengthen our bodies.
You know, this practice is not limited to just breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's also performed whenever sugar-laden snacks, such as cookies, donuts, brownies, brookies, whatever you want, are served at church activities.
So Mormons literally ask God to bless these sugar and fat-filled confections to strengthen and nourish us, because we all know that the Word of Wisdom is only about tea, coffee, alcohol, and tobacco. God overlooks sugar.
You know, maybe the blessings to nourish and strengthen blesses the sugar out of them. Mormons do believe in miracles, Brian.
So number two, the Mormon grieving process.
Mormon funerals are just a little different than other Christian traditions. While we do gather in our churches to pay our respects and share our touching and heartfelt stories about the lives of the deceased, there is really one primary purpose for attending Mormon funerals.
Funeral potatoes.
That is right. Funeral potatoes. And it's always served potluck style. While there's a wide variety of recipes for this grim delicacy, the basic ingredients include potatoes of every variety, thinly sliced, roughly shredded, even potatoes in the tot form. You can't forget butter, more butter, and about a truckload of cheese so thick that it matches the same depth as the potatoes.
And the crumbled cornflakes on the top. You can't forget that.
The basic concept of funeral potatoes is that Mormons have such a positive view of heaven and the afterlife that we've created a dish to help us get there just a little bit faster.
Number three, the official symbol of Utah is the beehive, which nobly represents thrift and industry.
But it's also the name of a hairdo popular among Mormon women for the past half century.
So the style is created by piling the hair on top of your head in a conical shape, sort of like a radio tower reaching towards heaven for direct transmission. Here's a clip of one Utah area woman who has embraced the beehive.
People always ask, is that real?
Stephanie Deere's beehive is the real deal.
It takes me 15 minutes to do my hair. It's very quick.
For about 15 years, she's rocked this vintage vibe right down to her undergarments.
It takes a while to get it on and a while to get it off. And you need to be able to go quite a bit of time without food because there's not room for you and a grilled cheese in there.
That was the first time I've heard that clip. I didn't know there was anything about grilled cheese. That's very interesting.
That's actually my favorite part. You can't get one of me and a grilled cheese into this dress. That's awesome.
You know what? Let's. I will leave that to experts like her. You know, Brian, there are some things that are unchanging. Traditional roles and traditional hairdos are one of the pillars of Mormonism. The fourth fact that we came up with, and again, this was a collaborative effort. We really thought hard about this. The Mormon emphasis on purity.
So Mormons are so intent on remaining unspotted from the world that they shun addictive substances, sex outside of marriage, rated R movies, and even wearing sleeveless shirts, short shorts, or two-piece bathing suits.
More than that, Mormons are so put off by vulgarity that they've even invented their own swear words.
That's right. Mormons may not cuss like sailors, but they can sure light up a faux swear fire like a Boy Scout who smashed his thumb with a rubber tent mallet. Or your good old dad who burned his thumb on the grill because that burger just needs to be flame-kissed a little bit more.
We turn now to a segment that we're calling Shiz Talking with Stephen Smoot. Stephen, how are things on the mean streets of Provo?
Well, you know, they seem to be going pretty gosh darn well, I have to say. Although, you know, both you guys lived in Provo at one point, right? Or you're probably familiar with Provo?
No, I've only driven through it.
Yeah, well, actually, that segues very nicely into what is sort of happening on the streets these days. So talking about driving through Provo, I'm sure you guys both know how really freaking gosh darn stressful it is to drive in Provo. Anybody that knows Provo knows it's infamous for its traffic being so fetching bad, right?
I think that they're always doing construction down there.
Oh, always, right? Like, it's just this golly gee whiz. It's just this crazy thing that they're always freaking doing. And I don't know, man. But anyways, this didn't have to do with construction. The other day, I was driving down Center Street in Provo, and I just wanted to yell, gosh darn it, because some jackwad rear-ended me, and this mother hugger seriously decided to just sort of peel out after he had done so, right? He didn't stop to exchange information. Nothing like this. This fetching loser just decided to peel off right after that. So, you know, if I ever get a chance, I'm going to find this guy and just kick him right in the backside because I can't deal with any of this kind of crap, right? So in addition to that, the other thing people are talking about here in Provo is this crazy heavy rain that we've seen this week, right? Like the shiz really got real, especially on Saturday when there was some like crazy heavy rain going on. There was some flooding in the streets and that sort of thing. And, you know, it just really sucks so badly, right, to have this kind of stuff happening. This, like, what the heck is up with this flaming Utah weather? What the F is going on with this Utah weather? It got so bad at one point that when the thunder cracked overhead, I just yelled out, shiitake mushrooms, right, and jumped out of my fetching chair. So I can't handle this, guys. I don't know. I think you got to take me off the streets here. The other thing that's kind of coming up, so it's August, right, and the new BYU semester is starting. So there's not a whole gosh darn going on right now, except for the fact that because the new semester is starting up, the crap is going to hit the fan with students looking for student housing, right? Like whenever the new semester is starting, there's a whole lot of crud that goes down with people trying to find housing. You know, sometimes we'll have friendships destroyed over people trying to find just any kind of fudge buckety housing you can get. So I don't know. That we'll have to see what happens there with that. I'll keep my ear on the ground for that to see if anything happens there.
You keep your ear to the ground and you make sure that you're taking the pulse of Provo, because you are a man of the streets and we need to hear your input.
Well, here's the last thing. Okay, so this is the other big thing. So besides the housing situation, the other news right now that's really sort of generating buzz in Provo is the fact that Imagine Dragons and Neon Trees, right, two sort of homegrown Provo bands, mm-hmm. they're actually going to be putting on a concert to raise some kind of awareness for LGBT activism.
Get the fetch.
And no, seriously, right? And I can imagine more than a few Provo residents just screaming, "Fetching Jiminy Christmas," when they hear about this, right? So, you know, but you know what? Despite all that, you know, by golly, I just think these guys make some great music. So, like heck, I don't even freaking care. Dang it. Imagine Dragons, I think they're going to do some great music.
Wow. Well, first of all, for our listeners, I feel like I should have given everyone a preface that you might hear some language that you might want to take some caution with this. Thanks, Stephen. You keep it real out there. You stay woke.
Well, thanks so much, guys.
Stephen Smoot, everybody. Speaking of offensive vulgarity and lewd behavior, do you know what recently rolled into Salt Lake City, Brant?
Well, since President Trump is on a 17-day golfing vacation, I don't think it's him.
The Book of Mormon musical.
Ah, that's right. Brian, have you seen it?
No, I can't say that I have, Brant. I mean, I'll be honest. I'm not really that interested in paying $150 to be mocked for 2.5 hours. I mean, I can get mocked and ridiculed on Facebook for free.
So wait a minute. You're telling me that you don't have rational discussions on religion, politics, social issues, and other hot button topics on your Facebook page? I mean, come on, Brian. Don't we all? But of course, many Mormons who have seen it seem to walk away from it saying, yeah, they were kind of vulgar. Yeah, they were disrespectful of my religion. But, you know, at the end, they gave me a big hug and said, oh, don't worry about it. Every religion's dumb. It's not just you, which made everything totally okay.
So, I mean, I know that Matt Stone and Trey Parker weren't doing this as an attempt of like just to seriously attack Mormonism out of any personal spite towards the religion itself. In fact, here's a clip of them discussing the show.
We grew up in Colorado and we both knew a lot of Mormons growing up. And it just, it's always fascinated us because it just has this, its own kind of unique creation myth. Just to an outsider, it is, it's just goofy. But, you know, we used Mormonism in the Book of Mormon to just talk about religion in general, because of course to anybody's religion, to an outsider, it's just as goofy. I don't think either of us think Mormonism is any goofier than Hinduism or Christianity.
So, but regardless of how they tried to frame their show, some Mormons are still deeply offended by it, including Larry Rigby, who published a letter in the Salt Lake Tribune that compared the Book of Mormon musical to Kristallnacht, which is the name that was given to the wave of anti-Jewish violent raids that took place throughout Germany in 1938.
Ah, Brian, this is my favorite type of Mormon, the righteous avenger. We haven't had one of them come onto the show in a long time. You know, maybe he doesn't see the issue comparing a salacious comedy to a pogrom against Jews throughout Nazi Germany, where approximately 91 Jews were murdered, but it's probably my fault that I don't get his comparison. I mean, sure, it's good clickbait, but it's feeding into a Mormon persecution complex that's already a little bit bloated.
I mean, yes, Mormons were pushed out of places in the United States and suffered terrible attacks. I don't want to minimize the brutality that many early saints experienced at the hands of religious bigotry. It's real. But Mormon persecution is, let's face it, nowhere close to the centuries of suffering and violence that has been done to the Jewish people.
And more importantly, comparing religious violence and brutality to an off-color Broadway comedy like the Book of Mormon musical is probably even more offensive than the musical itself. So look, let's get some facts straight, okay? Yes, it's profane. Yes, it mocks Mormons. But it's not dragging us out of our homes. It's not throwing bricks through the windows of our businesses. And it's not forcing us into labor camps. If anything, perhaps the Book of Mormon musical is just a good reminder for the writer of that letter to stop taking himself so seriously. I mean, it's very well known among many that from a public affairs perspective, the LDS Church hit a grand slam with their reaction to the musical back in 2012. They put playful ads in the playbill saying the book is better. And they're even doing the same thing in the Salt Lake City tour of the show. So please, let's tone down it just a bit. Besides, the whole Book of Mormon musical is persecuting me storyline is so 2012. As a matter of fact, I will show you how open I am to this whole thing. I'm even okay with Chris Hicks' column in the Deseret News about the musical. Deseret News, notoriously conservative. You would think that they're going to take a hardline stance against the Book of Mormon musical. Hicks doesn't express moral outrage at the way Trey Stone and Matt Parker portrayed Mormons. He said, I just don't care for raunchy comedies. And I'm perfectly fine if someone takes that approach. But please, let's all pump the brakes on this.
So moving on to our top story this week, Elder James Hamula of the First Quorum of the 70 was released from his calling as a general authority and was excommunicated from the church this week. And Brant, Mormons on the internet are losing their minds. Here's a clip.
This morning, James J. Hamula was released as a general authority 70 of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints following church disciplinary action by the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. The last time a general church leader was excommunicated was in 1989 when George P. Lee was removed from his leadership role due to apostasy. The LDS Church is not releasing the reason for the disciplinary action against Elder Hamula because generally church discipline is kept confidential. However, because of his leadership role in the church, it was announced to the public. We do know, however, that the action was not the result of apostasy, or in other words, teaching ideas that are in conflict with church doctrine.
So if you pay any attention at all to social media, this is the story that everyone's talking about, speculating on, and just like with any other big story, Mormons are going to morm, and ex-Mormons are still going to morm.
But of course, there is chatter online speculating about what the cause of excommunication was, because, you know, it's the internet, and that's what we do. The church offered no reason other than the preemptive statement that it was not a matter of apostasy or disillusionment.
So, as a matter of fact, I actually reached out to LDS spokesman Eric Hawkins directly to see if he could clarify why the statement written by the LDS church included not just that he was released, but the fact that he was excommunicated as well, to which Mr. Hawkins responded that there was no additional information besides what was released in the statement. So there's no context or background to Elder Hamula's excommunication, but as we both know, the disaffected communities online would love nothing more than a significant figure in church leadership losing their faith and being tossed out, totally validating their own decision to leave Mormonism. As a matter of fact, it leads back to one of Brandt's rules of online Mormonism. For every faith-promoting rumor, there is an equal and opposite faith-denying rumor. I mean, just look at what happened with European General Authority Hans Mattson a few years ago. At the time of his release, Elder Hamula was the executive director of the Correlation Committee, which we should note for the record.
So, Brant, I think we should start our own rumor mill here. In fact, I think that this might have been all sparked by those little jabs that you've been making at the Correlation Committee on this show.
Hey, now, that's a good little rumor. You know what, Brian? You should consider us the Woodward and Bernstein of Mormonism, except not as good. We don't have any deep throat sources and basically no journalistic credibility at all.
Not really.
But you know what? I'm willing to go with it. Okay. You know what, though? I prefer the rumor that one Redditor dropped. And you know, if we're actually like sourcing from Reddit, we are, you know, really scraping the bottoms of the cesspool there, that Elder Hamula was found in possession of, get this, University of Utah football tickets. You heard it here first.
Say it isn't so, Brant.
I know. But seriously, let's get down to brass tacks here, Brian. Let's get serious about this. Is this really any of our business? I mean, don't get me wrong. In the day of covered up sex abuse scandals and leaked documents, complete discretion in disciplining high profile church leaders is probably not a good idea. People expect transparency. But here's the deal. I really don't care why he was excommunicated, and he is far from the first general authority to be excommunicated.
I mean, particularly when you look at the history of the church. I mean, during its first half century, top leaders are being excommunicated on a near weekly basis, and some for such serious offenses as not keeping their cow out of their neighbor's yards.
Oh, Brian, let's not even get into that, because I can tell you, when my neighbor's cow comes into my yard, shiz hits the fan, if we're going to use Mr. Smoot's language there. Everyone, please do not misunderstand me. This is serious. Public discipline of someone like James Hamula does send a message that leaders cannot transgress with impunity. Additionally, if it was something illegal, I've got to imagine we will be hearing about it soon. If it's something more personal, that's between him and his family. I know on good authority that his family has been bombarded with inquiries as to what's going on, and they are exhausted. How would any of us feel if this were happening to, I don't know, our father, our husband, our uncle, our brother, with every second or third tier connection coming out of the woodwork because they want to scoop or because they just want to gawk? And again, because there's a lot to unpack here, he's also a public figure. When things have happened at major companies that I've worked at, there's an announcement of an immediate firing and potential legal actions for the high up executive involved, and not necessarily for low on the totem pole brand. This is what happens when you mix religion and business, because there are some rules on the business side when it comes to something like this. For example, what I described with the companies I've worked at. And there are some rules on the religious side. One of the things that we've known within the LDS faith is when there is someone who is excommunicated for high profile, you know, a high profile person who's excommunicated, they usually just say nothing, because that's not what they do, because that's part of the whole Mormon excommunication disciplinary thing. They don't say anything about it. We're all trying to figure this out. On the other hand, the fact that it has been nearly 30 years since the last time this happened does say something, right?
I mean, I think it points to a certain amount of stability. But, I mean, this is the first time that it's happened in the age of Twitter and Reddit, which I don't think is helping things with, you know, all the instant reactions and the hot takes galore. I think it only makes matters worse.
I totally agree with you. And you know what, Brian? When everybody has a source, then nobody has a source. And when everyone is trying to be that one person who's going to say that thing that's either going to get the most likes on Facebook or get the most upvotes on Reddit, I don't know if you're going to get very rational people that are talking about this issue. Because guess what? We're all feeding into this egotistical machine. And when you're trying to, you know, say things because you want people to notice you, it's not going to help much. For more on this, I think we need to get with our friend, Steph Lawrenson, with her segment, Sound Off with Steph.
So here are my thoughts on Elder Hamula, and it hasn't been something that I can even come up with something really funny or even sarcastic, because I think my first feeling is just overwhelming sense of sympathy for someone whose life has obviously just gone to hell. As someone who left the church, it's hard to leave. You lose relationships and community and family members. And so to be forced out, I think I just feel really bad for this guy. But then I started to think about, like, well, we don't know why he was excommunicated. And I think it's a dick move to try and speculate for why he was excommunicated. But I did notice a trend when I was thinking about it between who the church excommunicates and who the church doesn't excommunicate. And so obviously there were prominent people who are excommunicated for apostasy, like Kate Kelly and John DeLynn and the September 6th and scholars. And so, but then apparently though, you can be a white supremacist and stay in the church, and you can try and do a hostile takeover of a local government in Oregon and still stay in the church, and you can sexually abuse children and stay in the church. So there's this weird disconnect between who gets excommunicated and who doesn't. And the only pattern I found for who gets excommunicated, it isn't if they necessarily hurt other people, it's if they hurt the church. And so to me, it says that whatever happened with Elder Hamula, even if it wasn't apostasy or disillusionment, which is the only statement they've said, obviously whatever he did hurt the church as an institution, but probably didn't hurt other people, because that's not what the church excommunicates people for, obviously. And so to me, that makes the whole story a little bit sadder. And it just gives us something to maybe stop and think about, is if we are excommunicating people, should we be excommunicating people who hurt the church as an institution, or should we be excommunicating people who hurt other people? And I don't think we've found the right balance yet. And so for someone who most likely, and I could be totally wrong, this guy could be like an axe murderer who went up and like chopped up 20 million kittens, but from what I guess, based on the evidence, he did something to piss off the church as an institution. And his life already sucks a lot. And so maybe we shouldn't add to that by being shitty human beings. So that's my moralistic little soapbox rant, is that even I feel bad for a white Mormon dude at this point. And that hardly ever happens. And that's all.
And we'll be back with Melissa Leilani Larson. If you're looking for more current news coverage on Mormonism, why don't you try the Mormon News Report? The Mormon News Report is a weekday email sent hot and fresh to your inbox every day by 9 a.m. covering the top stories in Mormonism with just a tiny bit of snark. Our focus is on actual news from actual newspaper and reporters covering all aspects of Mormonism. If you're interested in signing up, email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com with your name and zip code. We use that for demographic purposes. You could like the Mormon News Report on Facebook. You could find us on Twitter at The Mormon News, or visit theculturalhall.com/Mormon-news-report for more information.
If you cut me off driving, spill your coke upon my shoes, there's just no telling what my mouth might say. I'll break out a string of non-profanity to make your ears curl in my religiously edited way. action will display a certain G-rated tone so as to not offend the man upstairs. That's when I say...
We'd like to welcome to the show Melissa Leilani Larson. Melissa is an award-winning playwright and screenwriter who has written 7 plays, has a feature film under her belt, and whose book Third Wheel, Peculiar Stories of Mormon Women in Love, was recently published by BCC Press. Melissa, it's great to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your background when you decided that you were going to pursue writing from the stage and the screen. What first gave you the writing bug?
Well, I think I've always had the writing bug. I read from a very young age. I think I was 3 or 4 that I first started to read by myself. And Dr. Seuss, Horton Hatches the Egg, and Home for a Bunny, I think, Little Golden Books. And I just, you know, I've always kind of been addicted to story. I love stories. I love hearing them. I love telling them. And so I pretty much went through most of school planning to be a novelist. I was planning to be a writer. I figured that I think it was in 3rd grade that I had an assignment to write a short story. And it just kind of clicked. And then in college, for kicks and giggles, I entered a playwriting contest. I saw a poster, and it was like for $500. And I thought, oh, I could write a play. I've been to the theater. Sure, why not? And I went home, and I wrote a play. I had no idea what I was doing. And I entered this contest, and I didn't win. And I thought, that's so strange. What? And so I took a class, and it was very, very different. It's a completely different mindset to write a novel than it is to write a play. And it was a very hard class just because I had to get my mind around it. But then when I figured it out, it was like, you know, there was a proverbial light bulb. And I was like, oh, this is great. And so I've kind of been writing plays ever since. And we don't need to talk about how many years that is.
Well, let's talk about a feature film that you co-wrote, Freetown. So this is a story about 6 Liberian missionaries who were caught in the middle of a brutal civil war in Monrovia. Freetown in Sierra Leone was their destination that they were trying to reach in order to escape the violence. But they faced a lot of challenges along the way, as one would expect in a feature film. So tell me, how did this film come together? Was this a screenplay that you'd previously written?
It was. I went to BYU at the same time that Garrett Batty, who's the director and one of the producers, went to BYU. We were in a couple of classes together, and he actually sent me a message on Facebook a couple of years ago and said, hey, I'm working on a project. Would you be interested? And we talked about it. And I said, this would be really great. And he had already started to do some of the research on these missionaries and what happened to them. And I'd never written a missionary movie. I'd never written an action movie. So it was kind of exciting.
And I mean, what was it like to work on a story that takes place in such a foreign country to begin with?
It was a little crazy. And also, I tend to be, you know, I'm a feminist. I want to write roles for women to play. So just the fact that it's going to be a Toyota full of 7 guys, that in itself was a foreign country. And it's like, okay, I need to get inside the heads of these guys who are, they're a different gender than I am. They are a different nationality. They look at we share the same faith, but they look at it differently. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of things to just kind of consider and walk through. It's very much getting in the shoes of another person and walking around.
Well, it felt very authentic to me. You really seemed to capture the spirit from their perspective of their environment, their cultural kind of situation that they were in, and how they would react and respond to things. And there was also just a ton of great quotes. I mean, one of my favorite was from, was it Abubakar?
Abubakar, yeah.
Abubakar, yeah. When he said, is faith supposed to be this exhausting?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we can all relate to that.
And Henry, the actor, he did a great job delivering that line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for those who aren't familiar, the director of this was also the director who did Saratov Approach.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So had a great cast. I mean, I highly recommend checking out this film if you can. But, you know, let's talk about your book, Third Wheel. This book collects 2 of your plays, Little Happy Secrets and Pilot Program. So let's talk a little bit about these plays. Now, Little Happy Secrets. Now, this won the 2009 Mormon Association for Mormon Letters Drama Award. Can you give us a synopsis of the play?
Sure. It's a play about Claire. She's a recently returned missionary coming back to BYU to finish her degree. And she is reunited with her best friend from before her mission. And she has strong romantic feelings for her best friend, Brennan. And the play is about her reconciling her faith with her feelings and eventually with this friendship.
It seems like the play was very well received, but you know, it challenged some people at the same time. It seemed like your audience was, it seemed like they loved it. At the same time, they're like, this is, you know, this is kind of pulling on me a little bit here.
I like to say that some of the best responses I've had to that show were from people who said, I didn't really want to see it, but I'm glad that I did. And I feel like that's like the power of theater. Like people go in, they don't expect to have an experience. They don't expect to be changed. And then they are. Mm-hmm. And that's great. That play was, it was really hard because it was like, I first wrote it in grad school and the response from my classmates was really, really great. Because a lot of them, I was the only example of Mormonism that they had even come across. Mm-hmm. And so they said, this is a voice we haven't heard before. And then coming back to Provo and thinking about producing the play was a little crazy because it's like, how is this going to go over? And I don't think there's anything really super offensive or controversial in the play other than the subject matter. Right. And so it was a little slow at first, but then the buzz got going and then people were really excited about it, which is great. I was afraid at first people were going to pick it.
Right.
write angry letters to the, I don't know who they're going to write their angry letters to.
To you.
To me. But, you know, that's a goal I have, which is to get angry letters, and that's why I've never gotten any.
So you're disappointed. You haven't achieved that status yet of getting ranty letters sent to you.
I would love that. But that's kind of the point.
If it makes you feel better, I'll send you an angry letter.
Thank you. I don't know if it'll be completely sincere, but I will take it.
Now, Pilot Program, the second story that you've collected, second play that you've collected in this book. I have to say up front, now, I wasn't in Utah in 2009 when Little Happy Secrets was running. I didn't move here until 2011, but I did get to catch Pilot Program.
Oh, sweet. That's great. Yeah,
and it was amazing. In fact, I mean, I'm not the only one who thinks so. It was the winner of the 2016 Association for Mormon Letters Drama Award, and it was shortlisted for the best original play by the Salt Lake City Weekly. So a lot of people love this play. It was also different from a lot of depictions of polygamy in play. So can you kind of give us a brief overview of the play for those who aren't familiar with it? And also what it was that caused you to look at polygamy in this light?
Sure. In a nutshell, the play is a contemporary piece. I knew I didn't want to write about polygamy in historical context, and yet I'm doing that in other projects. but as a single woman in the church, and what is basically a culture of marriage, you know, there's a lot of different expectations that people hold themselves to and that we hold each other to. And polygamy has always been a part of things, even when we don't talk about it. So I was really looking for a way to kind of deal with that kind of baggage, I guess, and that's another power of the theater, is you can deal with issues that you're thinking about a lot. And so I wanted to deal with it in a contemporary context, and I wanted to basically propose that the church is going to institute a pilot program where they bring polygamy back into practice, and you know, a small little pilot. And and the play is about a couple dealing with infertility and how they agree to the pilot and bring a second wife into their lives and all the awkwardness that ensues.
So, I think we'll talk about this a little later, but I think the thing that was always most interesting, now I'll admit, because I've been outside of Utah, it's tough to see the plays, obviously, but I've read a lot about them. And I think one of the interesting things that you do with a lot of your writing and plays is not so much take the boundaries and then go, yeah, this is the way that the LDS church is, but I don't like it this way, so we're going to go way outside. It's almost like you use those boundaries and say, okay, how can I either play within these boundaries to see what's going on there, or even kind of push them a little bit so they bend but not break? And so how does that fact, A, is that true? Is my feeling on that correct? And then B, how does something like that factor into, for example, pushing dialogues about LDS culture and as a either a commentary or an analysis of it?
I think that's a good analysis. I think that's pretty spot on. That idea that Mormonism as a culture and as a faith is, I think James Goldberg said it once, that it's like a big sandbox for artists to play in. And you kind of, one of the things you're doing in drama is establishing parameters for characters to deal with. And so you as the writer, me as the writer, I set the rules and then I just kind of let the characters go and see what happens and see how they react, because we all react to things differently. And I think that is, it's a really viable way to talk about some of the really tricky parts of Mormonism, because so many of us, I mean, such a big part of our faith is agency, and we all make choices and we all make choices for ourselves. And sometimes I think that we can get comfortable in the communal parts of things and want everything to be the same when really it's not how things work. And so it's really important to me that agency be a big part of my work, because it's a big part of my life and why, what I love about the gospel. that answer the question?
Oh, no, no, I think that was great. Okay. So let's talk about your most recent. Ooh, regent? Your most
I'm
recent.
A regent. Yes, I am. I'm royal.
It's hot. I'm sweating. Like, I'm just dripping with sweat, and I can't talk right. All right, let me try this question again. So let's talk about your most recent feature-length play called The Edible Complex. It was seen by nearly 15,000 children from schools throughout Utah. Tell me a little bit about the project, how it came together, and what the play was about, because 15,000, that's a lot of people.
Sure. I am very lucky to be part of a theater company in Salt Lake City called Plan B Theater Company. They're the ones who produced Pilot Program. And they have this great program called FEST, Free Elementary School Tour. And The Edible Complex was the fourth, I think it's the fourth play in that series, where every fall for the last 4 years, they have put together a tour of a new play written by a local Utah playwright, intended for elementary school audiences of a certain age group. Mine was fourth through sixth graders. And we put on the play for these kids for fall of, I think it was, mine was basically for all of November. So it goes on tour to, we hit schools in seven counties in the state. And I think the goal is to eventually hit all the counties in the state. And so it was a really great experience because I have never written for kids before. Jerry Rapier, who's the artistic director, he said, hey, we want to commission you to write a play. And I said, that's awesome. I have no idea how to write for children. And he says, well, you have ideas. I'm sure you have ideas. And I've always wanted to write a play about eating disorders, but I didn't want it to be a standard kind of run-of-the-mill after-school special. I was like, This is an interesting and important topic. How are we going to approach it? And so The Edible Complex is about a little girl who wants to grow up to be a chef. She'd be one of those kids on MasterChef Junior. Her name is Anna. She's 10. And she's from a, her parents are divorced. She lives with her mom. And the play is about her deciding one day, because she notices that her mom is on a diet, to not eat anything. She just decides that she's going to be like her mom and not eat, and that her life is going to be better. She's going to be skinny. She's going to be pretty. She's going to be like the women in magazines. And as she goes through the course of this day, though, as she gets hungrier, she gets more and more miserable. And the food that she wishes she could eat talks to her and says, hey, you want to eat me? And so it's built like a Greek tragedy. The Edible Complex takes place over the course of a day. And she learns that that your body image is based in what you are comfortable in, how you are comfortable perceiving yourself. And that's what's the most important thing.
So it's not like you're dealing with lightweight subjects here. Like, let's see, you talked about Mormonism and same gender attraction. You talked about polygamy, and you talked about eating complexes. And I don't know, it might just be my opinion. And Brian and Melissa, tell me what you think about this. But it almost feels like there's something different about plays versus literature or art or music that seems to bring out this different emotion from people. So what's one of the areas in Mormon plays that you wish some more aspiring writers would take on that would pull some of these different emotions out of people?
Well, I just think we don't have enough plays that just are about Mormons being Mormons. I think we have this problem, you know, like we have the Book of Mormon musical, which was huge and was on Broadway, and we will say, oh, hey, we didn't like it because it didn't have a good portrayal of missionaries. And I'm like, well, then you got to make one. You have to do something about it. You can't like let, you know, the South Park guys write your life story. And so I think that we need to have more both plays and movies about Mormon life, because that's what's interesting to us and that's what's relatable. Eric Samuelson, who's one of my professors, he's the master of this. I can't tell you how many, I want to say at least a dozen plays that he's written about Mormon people in normal situations, dealing with the crazy drama of everyday life. And those are the things that we just need. We need more of those kind of stories that we can say, oh, hey, this is my life on stage. I think the great thing about drama is that it's relatable. It's happening in the moment. You feel it. You're in the room with the actor. And that's something you don't have in any other format.
Additionally, you know, not to put words in your mouth, but you mentioned what Eric was talking about. And we've talked about this on our show before, but Scott Hales, the guy who wrote
Enid.
Garden of Enid,
He did an interview with the LDS Perspectives podcast. And one of the things that he talked about was he wishes people would just like start, hit the ground running in, if you're going to write about Mormonism and Mormon, he was using it in a fiction contest as far as writing, but like hit the ground running and quit trying to set up the stage for everything. And I think that's kind of where you go with a lot of that. Like, look, if you're going to go see a play either with the pilot program or anything else, like it's going to be, if it's got some Mormon context, it's like, welcome to this world. I'm not going to explain it to you. You can figure it out. And it sounds like that's kind of where you were leading a little bit too, right? Like, don't worry about all this other stuff. Just get in and go.
Well, that's, I think that's the thing, is that we want, you want to draw people in the deep end, because that's just good drama. I mean, part of, audiences don't want to be spoon-fed things. I don't, as an audience member, want you to tell me, oh, hey, this is what the story is going to be, and this is how you're going to feel at the end. I want to figure that stuff out. And so, yeah, drop your audience in the deep end. Give them enough clues that they can figure it out. The audience likes to feel smart. They like to have learned something on their own. And yeah, that's, I would totally agree with Scott that that's kind of what you need to do. Because with a good artist, the craft is there, and the craft will support, you will give enough details for people to know what's going on. So, and if you think, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, so going back to Scott Hales real quick here. So what he was saying is that we don't need to define everything for the audience. We don't need to constantly tell them that bishops are like pastors and wards are like parishes. You know, he said your audience is smart enough to figure that stuff out. If they can't, he was talking more about writing in print, but if they can't, they'll Google it if they're really interested, right?
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Another thing that Scott said, and this is just comparing it to what you said, to that James Goldberg called Mormonism a sandbox. Scott Hales called it a funhouse, incidentally.
Yeah. That's about right. Life is a playground and Mormonism is a sandbox / funhouse / crazy town. I didn't say that.
Crazy town. Now we have a third definition.
No, that's dangerous.
Crazy town. I like it.
I am so going to get myself in trouble. At times.
At times my house is a crazy town.
That's drama. We don't care if it's not drama.
So little known fact about you, though, you're a huge fan of Wonder Woman.
Yes.
Like, we're not talking just like t-shirt fan. Like, you've got a couple of t-shirts with Wonder Woman on it. We're talking like,
it's also, I have three t-shirts, but I'm going to.
Three t-shirts. Anyway. And you've got a large collection of the graphic novels and like paraphernalia and a popcorn bucket with Wonder Woman. And
I do. And it has a matching, it has a matching soda cup. I am a nerd, as Brant has already established. I just think Diana as a character, I was never a huge comic book person and now I am. So who knows what happened, but, she's always impressed me as a character, because she's just so very strong and very resourceful, and also very upbeat. She is always looking for the good in everybody. She's the least likely hero to, you know, to kill somebody. And she always tries to talk people down from the ledge. I always feel like she's very rude. She's very strongly rooted in her faith. That's a big part of who she is. And I think that, you know, we're kind of living in a time where people try to fuzz that out of characters. It's like, no, it's the least important thing, but it's really, really kind of central to who she is as an Amazon, and it informs her decisions, and it's where she gets her power from. And she says, my power is from the gods. And she totally believes that. And she's not ashamed of that. And I've always been very impressed with her, that she's a very, she's always going for the little guy. She saves people, and she does it very, no questions asked. She's just cool. And at all of that, and she's still not perfect.
How many times have you seen the movie?
Oh, you want me to answer that question? I have seen the movie.
Now we get to the hard-hitting question.
I have seen the movie 10 times.
My goodness. I love it.
I felt it's very important as a female filmmaker. This is a movie I've been waiting years and years and years to see. The fact that we have 18 gazillion Supermans. I've been waiting so long for Wonder Woman. She's finally here. It's a good movie. It was directed by a woman. I feel like it's really important to support it in the box office. So I'm doing my part, yo.
Well, I applaud you. I mean, on behalf of Patty Jenkins and on behalf of Gal Gadot, I applaud you for that.
Do you know Patty? Can you give me some time with Patty? Can I slip through a script? Because that would be awesome.
I'm sure Patty,
listening to this podcast, my name is Mel and you're awesome and I can write you if you want.
We'll make sure we forward it along.
Awesome.
I appreciate that.
Well, why don't we finish up with what you're currently doing for your writing projects? Now, you recently contributed a couple of sketches to a play that ran through June titled Indivisible. And that was kind of a political commentary slash satire.
It was a reaction. Actually, it might land closer to a documentary, a docudrama.
Oh, okay.
Everybody in the show, everybody in Plan D's lab, which is roughly 12 or 13 writers, talked to people on both the liberal end of the spectrum and the conservative end. And we tried to just really get inside their heads and think about what their opinions are about things. And then we created monologues, characters inspired by those conversations. So it was a cool thing. It was very eye-opening. As far as current projects, okay, so as far as the Crazy Mormon Funhouse Sandbox, whatever, I'm working on something that's potentially one of the hardest things I've ever done. And it's a story about, it's a different kind of pioneer story. It's a little dark. I've been working on it for a while. It's a script, not for a play, but for a film. Ooh. And I'm really excited because it's about some really exciting women in Mormon history. The film right now is called Jane and Emma, and it's about the friendship between Jane Manning James and Emma Hale Smith. Jane Manning James is an incredibly important person in Mormon history, and if we don't know about her, we need to do better, friends.
Absolutely.
Jane Manning is an incredibly faithful Latter-day Saint. She's one of the first Black members of the church. And she joined the church in Connecticut. And she and her family walked from Connecticut to Nauvoo, almost 800 miles in the winter, to find mm-hmm. The saints and to join the community of the saints. And she would eventually go west with the saints to Salt Lake, where she would remain until she was well into her 80s. She's always been an incredible pillar of faith. And if there was anybody who had, you know, reason to leave the church because people gave her a hard time, it was Jane, but she stayed. And she's just, she's an incredible example to me. And I'm really glad for the opportunity to work on this film. I've been able to learn so much about her. And I think history is a little sketchy. So one of the nice things about working on a project like this is that we can fill out her character a little bit more and hopefully just help people to fall in love with her as a person, even though the history is not super complete.
Ah, gotcha. So, Melissa, we want to chat with you just a little bit more about the film. Can you stick around just for a bit?
All right.
Awesome. Melissa's new book, Third Wheel, Peculiar Stories of Mormon Women in Love, is now available through Amazon.com and Utah area bookstores such as Benchmark and Writ and Vision in Provo. Check it out. If you want to hear the complete interview with Melissa, we're going to chat in just a minute. You can check it out on Patreon, which you can subscribe for just $1 a month. We'll be right back.
Scriptures are complex. Written over several thousand years by numerous authors from varying cultures and languages, many passages contain multiple meanings and possible interpretations. Furthermore, our present cultural situation unavoidably colors our own means of interpretation. What scripture scholars undertake is a study of the cultural situation of the text. Contemporary Studies in Scripture is an exciting new series from Greg Coford Books, featuring authors whose works engage in rigorous textual analyses of the Bible and other LDS scripture. Written by Latter-day Saints for a Latter-day Saint audience, these books utilize the tools of historical criticism, literature, philosophy, and the sciences to celebrate the richness and complexity found in the standard works. This series will provide readers with new and fascinating ways to read, study, and reread these sacred texts.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by todayinmormonhistory.com. 130 years ago this week, on August 12th, 1887, the 12 permits the former presidency to complete its arrangements for pro-Mormon coverage from the leading papers in New York and other cities by paying various newspaper editors $75,000 cash in advance, plus added $70,000 after Utah gained statehood. Heber J. Grant records, President Cannon stated that the parties with whom they were negotiating could secure the press of the country, that is, the leading papers in New York and other cities, to write articles in favor of our admission into the Union for the sum of $74,000 cash and an additional $70,000 after we were admitted. He stated that these figures were only about one-third the amount originally asked and that the papers considered their figures very light.
So much for our Fourth Estate not being bought, huh?
You know what, Brian? Good publicity does not come cheap.
And that's our show. We'd like to thank Melissa Leilani Larson for being our guest. Remember to check out the Mormon News Report extended sessions on Patreon to listen to the rest of our interview with her.
Here is a sneak peek to whet your appetite.
I noticed that specifically there are female protagonists involved with this. You've got Jane and Emma. You've got a female director and also you as a female writer of this. And let's also not forget the fact that you're also talking about people of color that are also involved, whether it's Jane or other situations. So can you talk about some of the significance of all three of those things seeming to come together around this story?
All of those things make this project really, really exciting to be a part of. And we've actually been consulting with Temu Smith and Xandra Rains, the sisters in Zion, because I know that they have a close relationship to Jane as a person and as a heroine, as someone to look up to. And it's really kind of important, I think, because we're at a place, a crossroads for the church and for our culture, where it's like we're realizing how many members of the church all around the world are people of color, and our culture, our cultural experiences, our art needs to be better at reflecting that.
Just visit patreon.com and search Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/Mormon News Report. We try and make it easy for everyone.
We'd like to thank Stephen Smoot and Steph Lauritsen for joining us. Music was performed by Scott Holmes. We'd especially like to thank you, our listeners. Hey, listen, if you like what we're doing, tell your friends about us and give us a review on iTunes.
For example, Brian, we've got a review. Rod Film wrote, "Fantastic, informative, and fun. It's just what my palate needs from the usually overrated and typically exhausting LDS Sunday. Keep up the good work." Hey, thanks, Rod.
If you want to reach out to us and let us know how we're doing, you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com.
Until next week, we'll talk to you again after a while.